On the mornings, weekday mornings, when I'm not leading the sit on Tuesday mornings through the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado's morning sit program, I oftentimes tune into the sit and talk being led by Gil Fronsdale in Insight Meditation Center of Redwood City, California. And he's just wrapped up doing a series there on karma and a little bit about how to understand the concept, how it relates to our daily lives, how to work with it on a moment to moment, day to day basis as we live our lives. It's one of those subjects that across all of the Buddha Dharma traditions, there's a very wide variety of thoughts and views and opinions that I just don't really want to burden us with right now. But to really try to get back down to basics and keep it as simple as possible, it's about the law of cause and effect. How the things in our own past that we did or that were done to us affect and influence the contents and the functions of our minds in the present time. You know, the thoughts and the feelings that arise, how we respond to external stimuli, how we go about making decisions. What are the things that go into discerning, you know, or constructing our intentions before we say or do something. Okay. So in insight meditation, one of the most important skills that we develop, and again, I'll be talking about this a lot next month in our Foundations of Mindfulness series, as to how to develop the powers of non-judgmental awareness so that whatever's coming up when we look at the activities of mind, right, we can see the thoughts and the feelings that we know to be unwholesome, which is to say, based upon anger or ill will or greed or misconstruence of things that they are as they are. And then how those thoughts and feelings, the energy behind them, can cause us to say or do things that are not helpful, that can be painful, harmful to ourselves and others. And then as we do the same practice a little more deeply, in addition to just seeing these things as they arise, the reason we call it insight meditation is because then the mind becomes able to see what are the root causes of those thoughts and feelings. Where do they come from? What's the energy that propelled them forward? What is it in our past, in the way we were treated, the way others treated us, and you know, the way we treated others, this ongoing confluence of interactions. What are the sources of these beneficial and unwholesome impulses that we either act on or that we don't? And then as this practice goes, the last step is to see if we can bring some kind of compassionate regard to bear on what's coming up in the mind, to understand karmic roots of the things that we don't particularly care for or don't like, and how to deal with them in a non-aversive way. So there are a lot of teachings in the Pali Canon and other Buddha Dharma traditions on how to do this. One of the lines of thought and teaching and metaphorical framing that has particular resonance for me is the are the ones having to do with wildlife. It's something I have some background in from my undergraduate days. The Buddha and the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, he says, the mind untamed and wild is like a powerful animal near human habitation that can do great harm, like a wild elephant on a rampage. But he said that same wild and powerful energy, if it's tamed and turned toward a beneficial purpose, can be enormously constructive and helpful. Even tamed, he said, this power can be used for good or ill. In the Buddha's time, for instance, elephants were used to build infrastructure and transport food and otherwise serve the peaceful needs of the populace. They could also be trained to make war. You know, it depends on the intention underlying the harnessing of that power. And that same metaphor is one that Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest meditation master from my own teaching lineage, used, you know, a well-known trope that I know that, you know, I've talked about a lot, and I think you probably all have heard a lot, which is to say that the mind is like a still forest. It said, be with your mind in such a way that it can function as a clear forest pool. Okay. So that all of the sediment and the turbidity and the discoloration and whatnot can gradually settle to the bottom of the pool. And so it becomes clear so that you can see all the way to the bottom. Okay. But if you are in fact also the pool itself, and you're looking up through it, said many strange and wondrous animals will come to drink at this pool. And you should be ready to, excuse me, my device is getting ready to die of starvation here. I need to get her back among the living. Okay. That instead of regarding whoever comes to drink, either with delight or aversion or indifference, he said that whoever shows up, whoever comes to drink, whoever comes to be seen is worthy of your regard. Okay. So, in the teachings I've been picking up from Gil Fronsdale for the last few, you know, last week or two, he said, you know, it's really important to have respect for your karma. Whether you find your own personal history of the things that were done to you, the things you did, everything else, to be pleasant or unpleasant, whether you find it hard to look at or easy to embrace, you need to respect it because it is your history. It's the history of who you are. And to the extent you cannot embrace your own history, then that becomes a limit on how you are able to continue to mature spiritually. That those aspects of your history, you know, that you cannot make peace with are the ones that keep you from being able to let go of the hold that they have on you, okay? So when we're doing mindfulness meditation and We're looking at what's going on in the mind. The discursive mind, and that's the storytelling mind, the mind, the aspect of the mind that's making, trying to make meaning, telling us who we are and who they are and what's going on. And it's looking at what else is going on in the mind and making judgments about it. Okay. The discursive mind comes up with its own set of rules about how it thinks the rest of the mind, the active mind. In some traditions it's called in the Theravada tradition a lot, it's called the monkey mind. You know, just this kind of frenetic energy jumping around doing whatever it wants to. And then applying its own rules to whether it approves or disapproves of what it is the monkey mind's doing. So within that trope, within that metaphor, I came across this book recently that I put the site for up on the chat column by Mary Roach called Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. And so she's a science writer, and she has collected this, all these different stories about wildlife coming into contact with humankind, almost inevitably and almost always, because the human population has intruded upon and disrupted the habitat of the wild animals. And their response is to return the favor. Kind of move in. Yeah. Oftentimes in what we call the wildland urban interface, but sometimes just kind of right into the heart of the city. And so what do humans do about that when wildlife show up and start doing things we don't approve of? Up until the 1600s in Western European jurisprudence, one of my areas of sort of study. It's really interesting because they tended, this was a time before the Industrial Revolution when, at least in the Catholic Church, the teachings of Saint Francis of Assisi really kind of held sway. And there was this Franciscan view that all creatures, great and small, you know, our Lord created them all and we need to treat them as we would wish to be treated ourselves. And so there is this really interesting period in Western Europe where really that was the case at law. Here's the introductory passage to Mary Roach's book. It says, on June 26, 1659, a representative from five towns in a province of Northern Italy initiated legal proceedings against caterpillars. The local specimens, went the complaint, were trespassing and pilfering from people's gardens and orchards. The summons was issued and five copies made and nailed to trees in the forests adjacent to each town. The caterpillars were ordered to appear in court on the 28th of June at a specified hour where they would be assigned legal representation. Of course, no caterpillars appeared at the appointed time, but the case went forward anyway. In a surviving document, the court recognizes the rights of caterpillars to live freely and happily, provided this does not impair the happiness of man. The judge decreed that caterpillars be assigned a plot of alternate land for their sustenance and enjoyment. By the time the details were worked out, however, the defendants, having pupated, which means transformed into caterpillars and into butterflies and flown away, were surely through with their devastations, and all parties no doubt left the proceedings satisfied. One of the things that I really liked about that is that it felt to me a little bit about like how our discursive mind tends to judge the activities of our own internal wildlife. These aspects of mind, the thoughts and the feelings, the ones we like, the ones we don't like, kind of running around, creating mayhem. It's humbling and it's humorous, but it's also, there's also a lesson in there somewhere, I think. Not just in terms of the, these interesting cases that she also taught from about the same period. There's in rural France, there was a pig that was tried for murder. Somebody had fallen into her sty and when she was with her piglets, and so, got recycled. And so then there is a trial and the jury found her guilty. And then presumably after her sentence, they ate her. But at any rate, back in those days, they actually felt that wildlife were deserving of due process, that they, even though they were applying these laws in ways that look to us today be pretty silly, at least they were saying, they're kind of beings sort of just like us, and so maybe we should try to treat them in the same way. And then in the Industrial Revolution, when that came along, there was this real divorce from that view. And during that period, and up until quite recently, both domesticated wild, livestock and humans were basically considered to be little more than productive economic units, to which no real meaningful rights would accrue. And so the organizations that we have today, like the Humane Association, Society for the Prevention of Cruelty in Animals, those all came to be in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when the Industrial Revolution was well underway. There was urbanization, and draft horses and things, for instance, were being used to haul stuff around in cities and being treated in many cases brutally. And in ways that, the founders of these societies said, you would not treat another human that way, and therefore you should not treat the animals this way, which is, kind of going back to the Franciscan approach. And so they established these societies to try to curb the brutal treatment of animals, but we're only now kind of starting to get back a little bit to where we were, like in the 17th century. At any rate, so much for that. You can fast forward to the present. Also in Mary's book, there's this chapter about the rhesus monkeys in India. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. They're about 1.5 to 2 feet tall, short gray fur. They look remarkably human in some ways. And they mostly eat fruits, nuts, and berries, the same diet as the Jains, which is one of the religions. They're also considered sacred as the children of the monkey god Hanuman in Hindu lore. And so there is a kind of a taboo on doing them harm, while at the same time, they're completely overrunning many of the urban areas in India, including Delhi, the capital. And so, for instance, rhesus monkeys can be found wandering the halls of parliament. They can be found in ministerial offices. They can be, they do a lot of damage, a lot of harm. One of the most striking of these, that if you ever go to India, you really need to be aware of, is that the rhesus monkeys keep a real eye out for tourists or anyone who doesn't really know how they behave. Mary Roach was in this chapter on the rhesus monkey. She said she was walking along with a bag of fruit one day on a trail and going for a hike on a rural area. And all of a sudden, a rhesus monkey's head appeared behind a boulder ahead of her. And she was with a photographer. And so they were all focused on the monkey. And while they were looking at that one, another one ran up behind her and grabbed her bag of fruit and ran off the trail up to where the other monkey was, you know. But more to the point, the head veterinarian for this region of Delhi said, when he goes to meetings, when most other people do, they put all their valuables, like their cell phones and their sunglasses and their wallets, in the glove compartment of their cars and lock them, because anyone who doesn't do that, the rhesus monkeys will run up behind them and they'll stick their hands in their pockets and see if there's anything. They're looking for food, anything they can find. If they can't find anything, they'll grab their cell phones and their sunglasses and their wallets, and they'll run ahead about 10 or 20 yards. And then they'll turn around and stand there holding their belongings and stare at them, create eye contact. And in order to get their belongings back, whoever they were taken from has to come up and offer them food. So what they're doing, they're ransoming their belongings, right? So they evidently find it easier to do that than they do kind of running around the forest looking for, you know, seeds and fruit and nuts and stuff. So the reason I'm telling these stories is because as I read them, I was saying, you know, I got to say that there are aspects of my own mind that are not a lot different, you know, from what these monkeys are doing. The monkeys are not, they're bright. They kind of know what they're doing. They know what they want. And they're going to do whatever they need to do to get it, whether we like it or not. When I was in the process of writing my second book, A Worship in a Wilderness, the one about managing sacred sites on public lands, I happened to be on retreat at Spirit Rock with Jack Kornfield and interviewed with him. And I told him that, you know, this is well along in my academic career. I said, you know, I'm finding myself in terms of my motivations and my intentions to be really kind of torn in that academic writing and publishing and career advancement, whatnot. A lot of it is about self-reification, you know, about puffing yourself up, about writing stuff and putting it out there and promoting it and getting people to recognize that you've done something of consequence and of value and saying nice things about you and whatnot. And I said, you know, as I go forth doing this project in service to the furtherance of my career, I realize, or I feel like, it's pretty counter to the Dharma, because it is reifying a sense of self. It's trying to solidify or create this image of myself as kind of hot stuff, right? While at the same time, I understand that the Dharma is about doing just the opposite. You know, it's just kind of letting go of this process of self-reification, of grooming some sense of self and putting it out there. And by that time, Jack had written a bunch of books, and they were selling well. And he was kind of a Theravada Buddhist rock star, you know. And so I said, "Well, how do you deal with that? You know, this, you know, on the one hand, you know, somewhat all these accolades and whatnot coming at you from having written these books, and at the same time realizing it's all empty and meaningless." And he said, "Well, as I listen to you talk," said, "it sounds like you're envisioning your ego as if it was some kind of caged monster, you know, that was in a corner, and that if you went ahead with your project, you were going to free it, and it was going to run around and wreck the place, you know, and all of your efforts at understanding the Dharma and self-realization would be wrecked, would be for naught. And what Jack said was, instead, try thinking about this aspect of you that wants to be seen, that wants to be honored, that wants to be recognized, you know. Think of it instead as a little three-year-old kid standing on the floor while you're sitting at your desk typing on your computer, and they're tugging at your sleeve and they're saying, I want some too. I want some too. Don't forget me. It was a really nice teaching, right? You know, this wild monster that I feared, you know, this wild animal. He said, you don't really need to see it that way. It's something that can be understood. It's just that little part of your personality needs to be recognized. It needs to be honored. It's what Gil calls respecting and honoring your karma. And so I kind of found that to be pretty helpful. And then, you know, going back to what the Buddha taught about the raging elephant, you know, and in fact, during the Buddha's 45 years of teaching, there were actually several attempts made on his life. One by a jealous relative who also wanted to be seen as a high-born and skilled teacher. Others by Brahmins that didn't like the fact that their whole power structure was being threatened by his teachings. And so I think it was one of his jealous relative set up a situation in which he brought a bull elephant that was a war elephant and drove it down a narrow alleyway, beating it and scaring it so that it was charging with great force down this narrow alley where the Buddha was. And as it approached the Buddha, it looked as if it was just going to trample him and kill him. And instead of trying to jump out of the way or not, the Buddha just stood and looked at it and blessed it. And of course, came to a stop and knelt down. So there's this notion that that which looks fearsome and scary, if you can see behind what's causing it to be that way, can transform. I don't know how many of you may remember this movie that Kevin Costner made a long time ago called Dances with Wolves. You know, this Western movie about this cavalry officer that's at this outpost, and he kind of goes native, literally. And becomes, you know, a member or a familiar, honored guest of a Sioux tribe, you know, Lakota tribe. And it was an expensive movie to make because he was so intent on authenticity. They said there were over 1,000 bison that were gathered together and driven around here and there out on the prairie to get the scenes that they wanted. And in addition to that, there was this like little battalion of highly trained bison that were out there as well, that you know, were owned by handlers, you know, that did a lot of work with Hollywood. And and bison, they kind of have a mind of their own, but It is possible to train them if you find the right ones and they're in the right mood. And so there's this one scene in the movie where there's this little girl who's out on the prairie during a buffalo hunt. And this one buffalo breaks loose and is pretty enraged about the whole thing and starts charging toward the hunters. And this little girl's in the way and this buffalo is bearing down and pounding along, you know, at a rapid pace. And it's about to run the little girl down. And Kevin Costner shoots it and becomes a big hero. The bison they actually shot were made out of fiber. There were fiberglass robots. So he didn't actually, shoot a buffalo that fell down. But the buffalo that they filmed charging, I saw footage later on of that scene being shot, and what the buffalo was charging toward was its trainer, and its trainer was holding out an Oreo cookie. And that was that bison's favorite treat, So this murderous charge that was being filmed in the movie was this buffalo running to get its Oreo, sometimes when there's really powerful negative energy arising in my mind when I'm sitting about this or that, I can say to myself, it just wants its Oreo. It really is possible, I think, to kind of domesticate these wild animals that run around inside of our minds. So those are some thoughts. And I would love to spend a little bit of time now sharing any of your thoughts or observations or questions about anything I may have brought up so far. Please. Please, Gloria.
I'm not entirely sure how this is connected, but my mind kept going back to a scene in Aldo Leopold's book, The Sand County Almanac. I think one of the most beautiful books ever written about environmental. Yes. And yes, he talks about the scene I kept coming back to was, I think the last time he hunted, the last time he shot an animal was a wolf. And he got there in time to see it die and talked about the wild green fire that was leaving it. And it suddenly, in a real powerful way, he got it that, and I was sitting here trying to think what he got. There was a connection that was either lost or gained or both. But I was very moved about how he, because, when he started out writing this book, he was kind of a middle-level bureaucrat. And it was his experience in not particularly dramatic ways, just being with the natural world in as quiet and a non-interfering way as possible. Allowed for his spiritual growth is kind of what I got out of it.
I remember that one of his sons, Starker Leopold, is the guy that I took my wildlife biology course from at Berkeley. And the other of his sons was on my PhD committee when I wrote my dissertation about American Indian water rights. I feel it's kind of a personal connection with the Leopold family, but I remember that scene, that really poignant scene. He was what's called a timber cruiser for the United States Forest Service at the time. You're right. He was a bureaucrat in the Forest Service. And what timber cruisers would do is that they would travel through the national forest and they would estimate how many board feet of timber might be able to be harvested out of a particular forest. At the same time, both wolves and mountain lions were being systematically exterminated under state law, but also under National Forest Service policy, because they all predated on livestock. And so it was the official policy to kill off all the predators so that there'd be, you know, you'd be able to run more livestock on the public lands. And so that was the context in which they shot the she-wolf. And you're right, you know, that was the moment at which he just kind of looked around and said, what am I doing? You know, what am I doing? You know, I'm supposed to be a steward of this forest, but all I'm really doing is measuring how many, the dollar value of all the trees we're going to cut down out here. And we're killing off the predators so we can put more and more livestock to graze on land, knowing that it's going to destroy the land. And that turned out to be one of those, you know, one of those moments in his life, you know, as you described it. And he said, just as deer live in mortal fear of wolves, so too do mountains live in mortal fear of their deer. And the chapter in the book is called Thinking Like a Mountain. And so what he was saying is that if there are no predators to control the deer population, that the deer population is going to run rampant, and that it is going to, you know, rip all the undergrowth off the mountainsides. It'll eat the seedlings of the trees that are being born. It will pretty much denude the landscape of the vegetation that needs to hold water and soil, if there are not predators to keep the deer population in check. And so, yeah, that was his realization that in our greed or our delusion, our, you know, our simple ignorance, you know, that we are poised to do enormous harm to the world around us. And that was actually one of the events that kind of woke him up. So, yeah, thank you. There's been this effort for a long time now to try to reintroduce wolves into the wild lands, into the wilderness areas of Colorado. And the state, you know, Fish and Game Commission is a highly political organization. Both the, you know, the ranchers and the herders and the hunters were adamantly opposed to allowing the wolves to be reintroduced to Colorado because of predation on livestock, and also because wolves are really good hunters. They take down a fair number of elk and deer, which means less elk and deer for the hunters, right? But the voters of Colorado decided, you know, we could use some wolves around here. So the wolves are now being reintroduced. Even the leadership at Rocky Mountain National Park was against it, even though the elk are just devastating that environment. You know, they're destroying all the streamside habitat and the marshlands, and making life really hard for the beavers, for instance. But they didn't want to have the wolves come in part because wolves aren't necessarily really tidy in the way they feed themselves. And so with all these elk running around, there's the real possibility that the wolves are going to take down some elk in a very unphotogenic way in places where tourists hang out, right? Which is, you know, going to be kind of very un-Disney-like, you know? And the other thing is that some of the people that live in Estes Park weren't too thrilled about it, because if the wolves become very well established, you know, they're opportunistic, they're going to They don't want to work any harder than they have to for a meal. And just as the elk come down into town, and they're considered to be a huge nuisance because they devastate gardens and lawns and, you know, eat everything down to the ground, the wolves might start to get the same idea. And if they start to make their way down in town, the people that live in Estes Park are worried about little Muffy. You know, like, wolves are going to eat whatever comes their way, you know, and it's easy to take down. So, yeah, so there's that. And again, I want to try to make sure I loop it back into the Dharma before we go our separate ways, which is we might have really mixed feelings about the wildlife that we find within us, you know, whether we approve or disapprove of their behavior. The Buddha said in the numerical discourses, he said, the mind unguarded is capable of great harm and devastation. The mind adequately trained is capable of great good. You know, having grown up with dogs in my childhood and whatnot, I've always had a real fondness for and a keen interest in the history of the relationship between humans and canines, and the domestication of dogs, which it's as near as we can tell about 8,000-9,000 years ago in Eastern Europe, Western South Asia. Most of the humans there were hunters and gatherers, and they were semi-nomadic. And they would run around and hunt down things that tasted good to them and that were, you know, very nutritious, you know, various kinds of antelope and deer and other ungulates. And gradually, instead of just chasing them and running them down, they noticed that, of course, that they tended to hang around where there was the most food. So what they started to do was to gather the kind of food they knew their prey liked to eat. And they'd put it out and just hang out. And then the prey animals would come in and start grazing. But instead of killing them all, they would just maybe take one or two, but then they'd keep putting food out. So gradually more and more of the animals they liked to eat would gather around, and they would continue to feed them. And not only would they continue to feed them, they would protect them from the predators that were killing them, mostly wolves. And so gradually over the course of a couple thousand years, they domesticated sheep and goats and cattle and whatnot that were happy to hang around as long as they didn't all get killed and be fed and be protected, right? And so the hunters figured they'd stumbled onto a really good thing, you know, and this is a much more comfortable and easier lifestyle than what they'd been up to before. And so they instead of becoming just hunters and gatherers, they became herders. But then, of course, there was a problem because once they had all these nice fat livestock hanging around that they were taking care of, the wolves kind of noticed that. They said, you know, instead of us having to run all around and chase these wildlife like the hunters did, how about if we just kind of sidle up to these herds that they have and chow down on them? And so they started to do that. And just, you know, after the hunters became herders, then all of a sudden, these wolves that had been and other wild canines that had been running around on the same landscape competing for the same animals started predating on the livestock herds. Okay. And the herders would fight them off and try to kill them and whatnot, but it was kind of a pitch battle. It was sort of ongoing, and the wolves were making some real inroads. One of the things that the herders noticed was that the wolf packs were competing for access to their herds. And the most aggressive and the stronger wolf packs were chasing off the other wolves so they could have exclusive access to the herds. Noticing this, the herders thought, well, instead of just trying to kill them and run them off, how about if every once in a while we sacrifice a sheep and just feed these really aggressive wolves? And so they began to do that. In part as a way of keeping the wolves from willy-nilly just taking out their livestock. They'd take some sheep that was sick or wasn't doing well, or they maybe were going to have to put down anyway, and they'd just kill it and put it out there for the wolves to eat. And the wolves thought that was a great idea because they didn't have to, you know, risk being killed by the herders if the herders are actually feeding them. And so this goes on for a few hundred years. And what happens is that the wolf packs that the herders are feeding turn around and drive off all of the other wolf packs. So they have kind of entered into a contract with the herders. You feed us and we'll keep all these other wolves from chowing down on your livestock. And so that's kind of how the domestication of the dog began. You know, they became, instead of enemies of the herders, they became allies. And gradually, as they were getting more and more reliable food, they would start coming into camp. And then they would, the herders would feed the ones that were friendly, and they would kill the ones that were too aggressive. And so over time, these wolves turned into herd dogs. They were very good at keeping all the livestock together in one place, and they were very good at running off the other predators. Okay. And so I know, again, this seems like kind of a, you know, out there story, but what I'm trying to bring it back to is that just like the Buddha said, you know, the mind unguarded and wild is capable of great harm. The mind tamed and trained is capable of serving the cause of enlightenment. So it's the metaphor has meaning and salience for me in that it's kind of about these things that we find troublesome in us, you know. Maybe it's worth inquiring into ways that they might be tamed, that we can have a look at what it is that causes us to feel aversion. What is it about those forces that are troublesome? You know, like my default option pretty much went from the time I wake up in the morning is aversion, you know, is looking for threats, looking for things I don't like, trying to protect myself from them. You know, it can have negative manifestations, but if I get on the cushion early enough in the day, I can say, okay, well, yeah, it's like the junkyard dog or something, you know, it's like an over-aggressive sheepdog or something. Okay, I understand you're trying to protect me. I understand you're trying to serve me, but you're doing it in a very unskillful way. So then you, it's like honoring that unskillful effort, what for its underlying intention, and then saying, and the nature of your effort is unneeded and unhelpful. And if we can kind of establish that relationship with that energy, then a lot of things become possible. Me dos centavos, you know. So the book is a hoot. I really recommend it. It's funny. And there's a couple of chapters that she divides the thing into felonies and misdemeanors. And the felony chapters, some of them are cheerfully gruesome. I wouldn't try to, you know, like I would not advise doing what I did, which is to try to read those over breakfast, you know. But I think you get a kind of a kick out of the book overall. And there is in fact a little backdoor dharma in there. So. Okay. Any final questions or comments that anyone would like to share? Okay, my friends, let's settle in for just a minute. Find our sitting posture, allow our eyes to gently close. Attention coming to rest on the breathing. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we make peace. With all of our inner beings and their outward manifestations. May we be happy. And may we awaken. Thanks for coming around.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you next month.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd. Thanks. Have a good week.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Happy autumnal equinox.